Good morning. We'll start today's study session by excusing the mayor. He is currently out of town. I believe he's discussing transit issues back east. So that is it's a very good thing for the city of Mesa, given what we're doing. So we'll start with item number one, review items on the agenda for November 21st. Get it working?
No.
Go right ahead. All right. We will start with items 1 through 4A. 4B through 4F. 4G through 4K. Most of these are contracts. 4L through 4N. What do you want?
Pass envelopes, yeah.
No, look at that. We did.
We did.
All right. Then I have a question. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's 4I.
4I.
Yes.
Councilwoman Higgins.
Thank you, Vice Mayor Summers. The question I have on envelopes, so it's very exciting, I know. But did we ever look, and can our system handle the ability to get like an e-bill and then get like a rebate on your power bill because you're willing to get your bill in the mail or at via email?
Vice Mayor, Council Member, yes, we are looking into that right now. It's an active project.
Great. And is that something City Edge would be easier to do than what we're currently doing?
Probably not related to City Edge.
Probably not related. So we could do it now with our normal system?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. What time frame do you expect?
Hopefully the next quarter or so we'll be finished with the evaluation, figuring out what we can do.
Because this would save some cash here, right?
That's correct.
Right. Thank you.
Seem to recall we've had that conversation, I think, the last time we ordered paper. Where were we? L through N? Anybody there? What's that?
Excuse me, Vice Mayor.
Yes.
4J, which was right after 4I. The helicopter, the infrared stuff, we can't let this go by without chatting about it a little bit. Right? Because otherwise the guys got all dressed up for nothing. So.
I know how they feel.
So just, like, tell us what you found and what you think and...
We were asked to take a look at whether or not a lease option rather than a purchase might be something to consider, and lease option turned out to be much more expensive than purchasing it. The lease itself for 1 year would be almost $255,000. That would just be the camera itself. Then every year we'd have to go back to renegotiate a lease again. So the purchase is still the best financial option for us.
And so supposing, like, we get a new helicopter, replace an aging one, all this equipment's easily transferable into a new helicopter?
It's all interchangeable. This camera will work on all of our existing helicopters with the existing cabling that we have.
And would it, like, the cabling that's there, is it something that would be in a new helicopter, too, so it could easily kind of... It's pretty interchangeable is what you're trying to say.
It's interchangeable with all of our current AIMD 500 helicopters.
Great.
Yes.
Thank you.
And Vice Mayor and Councilmember Higgins, at the last meeting we had, we were directed to give a 5-year, 10-year strategic plan. We are planning that. We'll be giving you all the information on the different helicopters that we have.
Mr. Richens, you're out of order.
talk about our CIP replacement program that we have scheduled out. Our plan is to go through public safety with that presentation first to kind of work out any issues.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Chief. 4O through 5A. 5B through 7B. Yes.
Question, Vice Mayor. Item 6A.
6A?
Yeah. Does anyone have like a little short synopsis they'd like to share on that item?
That's one of the presentations.
That's the presentation later on.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Dave, did you have something?
No.
You're good? Okay.
Fantastic.
Anything about items from citizens present or adjournment that anybody has a problem with? No? All right. So we will move on to 2A to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the Central Maine Plan, which we have copies of up here. Mr. Wesley. Good morning, sir. Good
morning, Vice Mayor, members of the council. Get the button pushed. Okay, he pushed the button for me. Appreciate this opportunity to address you some more about the Central Maine Plan. As you know, we are nearing the end of a two-year process on this, getting ready for the actual public hearings, and so I wanted to review the plan document with you and see if you had any input for us at this time. The project has been a joint effort between the planning department, the economic development staff, and the transit staff to prepare this plan for the future of the downtown area. We have the draft plan available. We passed out some hard copies there in case it's of benefit to you this morning as we go through. You do also have it in your drop boxes on Legistar so you can look at it electronically, but we wanted to make sure you had a convenient way to refer to it as we talk about it this morning. Draft plan has been available to the public since late September when we had some community open houses, received some input through that process. And then our plan advisory committee that's been working with us has made their recommendation on the plan, subject to a few items that we are adjusting based on their direction and getting the final document out, but they have recommended approval of the plan. Our objective today, again, is to provide you an overview of the entire document, and then I'll see if you have any questions or comments for us today, and be prepared for any other comments you may have as we go through the public hearing process. This plan has been developed with the emphasis on being prepared for economic development impacts that light rail will bring to the downtown area, and that's been a chief focus. In doing that, we have really focused on three areas. One is to establish a vision for the future of this light rail area, and the type of community we want to create along the light rail line. We've recognized the need for the city, along with some of our partners, to help set the stage for that development to occur in the future, and then also need to be prepared to work with the private market as they come in and take advantage of the things we've put in place. And so our presentation today is organized on those three topics and follows the outline of the plan. As mentioned, the vision, we've seen this slide several times before. These are some of the background ideas we had as we started the process and worked with our plan advisory committee on to help verify the idea that we do have the light rail coming. We want to leverage that resource that we have, create a more transit-oriented development pattern, and take care of economic development that can occur with that. We established early on five guiding principles to set the stage and give direction for future development within the area. First of those is a prosperous community. You'll find these in the plan document itself in Chapter 2, starting on page 3 of the document. You'll see these in a little bit more detail about what we mean with each one of these. Prosperous community, again, deals with the economic development aspect. People-friendly community, looking at things that we need to do to help make our Main Street area more inviting and attractive and safe for pedestrians. So as we draw those people in to work and to shop and to recreate, to come for entertainment, that they have a place that they really want to be. A diverse community, guiding principle, focuses on having diversity of architecture and building and uses within the area and being a place a diverse number of people would want to come and enjoy and recreate. Distinctive community deals with placemaking ideas that we want to make this a place that is distinctive, that stands out, that creates that sense of place where people will want to be and have that new development fit in with the existing character of some of the areas that we want to preserve. And then finally, the last of the guiding principles deals with being environmentally conscious, that as we do this, we want to take advantage of some of the latest sustainable development practices, that we want to look at our environment. We know that Arizona gets hot during certain times of the year. We need to be sensitive to that environment and make sure that we take care that we're providing, again, a place that people can be in those extreme climates, as well as providing a healthy place for people to live and to again, live and recreate. So as we work through those, they led us to an actual vision statement. We have a lead into it that kind of creates that image, that feel of what we envision the future of the downtown area to be, a place where people can come and live and work and find the variety of things they want. And it's culminated in that catchphrase at the bottom, Central Maine, a place for people alive with options. We think this picture helps illustrate that idea of what the future for downtown is. And so with that vision that we've worked through and provided in Chapter 2 of the plan document, we work from there to identify those things, those policies, projects, and programs that need to be implemented, again, by the city and some of our partners to help move us forward in realizing that vision. And so I'm going to turn it over to Jeff to talk a little bit about how we've done that and the projects and programs.
As John mentioned, we've got this set up by five guiding principles. We worked for several months with our plan advisory committee then to develop the policies that we think would implement those guiding principles. And then within those guiding principles, there are only 23 pages of projects and programs that we think will implement each of those goals. Starting in Chapter 4 on pages 10 through 33 are tables that we have set up that show each of those projects and programs. They've been set up to show whether they're an important action item, give a brief description of them, shows which agencies will be responsible for implementation and which ones will be partners. We've met with most of the departments that are been assigned to talk about the priority and timelines and the future budgets and staff that may be necessary to implement these into the future. On the next page, we wanted to go over a specific example. This is on page 12 of the document, if you're following on. This is under the Prosperous Community Guiding Principle, Goal 3, which is related to creating a safe, attractive, and well-designed built environment that enhances community image and stimulates pedestrian activity. The project is Project 3.3, and it's related to infrastructure improvements and specifically about going through and modeling the Central Main Plan and the future build-out potential for any infrastructure improvements that may be necessary to help attract future non-residential and mixed-use development. It was identified as an action item, meaning that we think that this is an important project that needs to be done in the first year or two following adoption of the plan. And the lead agencies were Energy Resources and Water Resources, since they're the main utility providers, with partners from engineering, transportation, transit, planning, the private utility side. And as you see on the right-hand side, it's been identified to start implementation in 2012 and will be an ongoing effort so that even after we've modeled this 5 years from now, we may need to go through this process again and see whether there's still any more infrastructure improvements that need to be done. And by this, we mean infrastructure improvements that could be above ground as well as below ground. On the far right-hand side, you see there's two dollar signs and one stick person. That's intended to represent a moderate budget requirement to go through and do this analysis, but still be able to do that with existing staff resources.
Thanks, Vice Mayor. Just a generic. Was this your tool that you guys came up with? This is cool thing. I like it, Jeff. It's cool. I mean, it's really easily, understandable.
You look at all 23 pages.
Well, I think it, okay. So far, so good. How's that?
Thank you. That
Dave.
I'm sorry, Jeff. Is the idea here then to pull these projects into the capital improvement plan?
With this specific project, the idea is first we need to identify those ones that we think are the most important, do a prioritization of those, and then try and get them into the capital improvement program if they are capital projects. Some of these are not capital projects. They are development and design guidelines or design standards. But yes, at some point we will be.
So who would be responsible for going to this plan, looking them up, and submitting them when we review our next capital improvement plan? Is it the group that you identify in that? So Energy Resources would say, hey, reference this plan. This is in the capital improvement.
Yeah.
And so that's something that we could look out for next time the capital improvement plan came before us?
Exactly.
All right, thanks.
Additionally, since
Dennis has a question. And just to follow up on that, how do we as a council know the status of the projects that you're trying to get into the capital improvement plan so that if we have to weigh in or if for some reason the identified departments are having difficulty getting a project into the plan, shouldn't the council at least be, how will the council be aware of that, those efforts in case we want to weigh in and give directions?
I think both Councilmember Richens, Councilmember Kavanaugh, your question I think leads in well. One of the action plan items we have is the establishment of a citizens committee that we think is the keepers of the plan, that we would staff, and hopefully one of their jobs would then be also to help us prioritize those projects that they think are most important for implementation of the plan. And maybe in doing so, they would also be able to then present those findings themselves to the council. I think it's also responsibility as us as staff to keep you informed periodically as to how we are doing on implementation of the plan. One of the check boxes that we have on our table is the implemented check box, so we can keep tabs as to how we're doing as we're going through and making sure that we are checking off those ones that we think are the most important.
Dennis, and just a follow-up question to that. One of the concerns last year, several years ago, when staff recommended to the council agreed to eliminate the Downtown Development Committee, you know, how do we have a mechanism to oversee issues like this? So this, in one sense, could be a kind of a slight reincarnation of that committee, but not necessarily with, you know, planning and zoning authority in the same way that we had before, but it certainly would act as a focus group or focal group, I think, to assist the council in policymaking, which I think is a good recommendation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Additional action items that we have, we've talked about these in previous presentations to council, but the zoning changes, the form-based code is coming along very well. On December 8th, Opticos Design will be here to present the public review draft of the form-based code. It'll be a joint session with the Planning and Zoning Board, so you can look forward to seeing how that effort has gone. We just discussed the Citizens Committee. We also have several action items related to development of guidelines and standards, creating or enhancing existing marketing programs to market downtown and the Central Main area. We have several incentives that we think could be helpful in encouraging the type of development that we're looking for. John mentioned the healthy living environments, trying to make the place that we live as healthy and have as much opportunity for exercise and fresh foods that we can. And then finally, capital improvement programs, which we used as our example. By way of understanding how we developed the plan, it's a character-based plan. It's not a land use plan, so you won't see many recommendations as to what type of land use goes where. We've made recommendations about each character type has a feel, a sense of place that we want to create, and we have set up some general guidelines for what we think you need to do to create that place. So by looking at the map, you'll see that in the darker areas, that's where we think the most intensity will happen. They're generally the downtown area and the light rail stops. The yellow area is our existing residential stock, so we think that for the most part that we want to maintain that. It provides a nice variety of housing options, and for the most part, the single residence neighborhoods in this area are pretty well maintained. A couple specific examples of how the plan identifies character areas. The top one is what we consider an urban gateway character area. This is the intersection at Main and Mesa Drive. The plan for that character calls for vertically mixed mid-rise buildings that will transition between the higher intensity uses that are in the downtown core and the lower intensity uses that would be to the south and north. We'd expect a three-story minimum, buildings that are close to the street, creating a street wall, and that have a active streetscape so that the first floor levels will be active retail or something along that line so that the streetscape is active. Just in this picture, you'll note down around the courts and the Wells Fargo building, that's actually got the building blocks of the type of development we think would work well. A parking structure that's surrounded by multi-story buildings. There's some room to fill in there, but that's kind of the bone structure that we think could happen on the north as well. On the opposite end of the spectrum, the neighborhood maintenance area, this example is from the Gilbert and Main intersection, the northwest corner. The intent of this character area is to try and enhance and maintain what we already have. and would typically include residential uses that are 1 to 3 stories in height. It may include some additional residential redevelopment, some small-scale multi-family mansion apartments, but they would all fit with the character of an existing single-family neighborhood. Along the same line, we recognize that you can't just look at the character of the buildings and the private property. The street has just as much importance in how you create place as the buildings themselves. We often say that a four-lane or a six-lane road with 45 mile an hour speed limit and a narrow sidewalk that's attached to the street is never going to create a place. No matter how nice the building is next to that street, you're not going to get people that want to spend time there. So we've identified several different street character types that also have some guidelines for what we think could happen over time as it redevelops to help create that character.
Let me ask you this. In looking at this map back on slide 15, it looks like we're back in the business of drawing maps with colors on them. And we purposefully moved away from that when we completed the Mesa Gateway area, the Proving Grounds, the Mesa Proving Grounds map. And what we elected to do instead was to get very pictorial in our descriptions of the types of building, the type of environment we wanted to create there. So what you have are literally photograph after photograph of high-quality buildings, urban densities, and the area was divided into zones. So when you have one zone that was intended for employment, rather than saying this is employment and this is educational, you threw all the potential uses in there, and you had pictures of all that potential use, and you said we're looking for density and verticality and transit-oriented development. And here are the photos of from cities across the nation that have that kind of look. And then when there was a residential area, you said here are the various types of residential from low to medium. It could be anyone in between here, and here's what it would look like. Again, with the high quality pictures, some of it was dense, some of it was far. And now we return with it. And I think what we came up with was a fantastic project, and everybody who comes to my office who wants to do development there says, I've looked at the plan, I get it. And they show me pictures of other projects. And so we're looking at something like this, and we think it matches the pictures you've shown. It's amazing how well that guides development, or at least so far. And we're back to colored maps. Why are we back to colored maps? It would seem that it might be better to divide this area up a little bit as you did, but then start showing, get pictorial. Go back to the method that we have used in other parts of the city. And Dave might have some input on this.
Yeah, I think the differences are twofold. One is the area that we were talking about, nothing exists there now, or very little exists there now. And so we needed to set a vision for what that area should look like in the future. Here we have a lot of existing uses that we're trying to deal with. The difference between these colors and the colors on maps that we talked about previous are these are the other maps were depicting where we wanted uses to occur. You know, you draw a colored map. This is zoned for this kind of use, and this is zoned for this kind of use. This is different in that this indicates what kind of buildings forms we want and what kind of development character we want in that area. So it's not use, it's shape, it's
this
feel,
almost
it's character.
Feels more like use than what we did at Gateway.
It's because not, and that's going to be the transition that we're going to have a hard time with, because we're used to, as a regulating body, regulating use. That's what Euclidean zoning has been about for years. And my neighborhoods are having a hard time getting their head around this because we're so used to regulating use.
We got yellow residential, we got pink transit, we got blue diamonds, pink clovers, and no, we have an urban gateway.
You sound like you're describing your Lucky Charms bowl this morning.
That's what I was exactly doing. That's exactly what I was doing. I wonder if there isn't a better way to mix these two. For example, I mean, we could, if we want to talk about what kind of building stock we want downtown. Go take a picture of what downtown looks today. Use that picture and fill it in with other buildings and other quality buildings and on that map. And that would give you an idea of what we're looking at. I think there's ASU does some of this work. 12-year-olds do some of this work.
If you read the descriptions in this plan, I think it very clearly sets what the character is that we're going for in the downtown. I don't think it's confusing at all. I don't know that I need a picture to illustrate it. And most development people that are coming in to urban cores, they get it. And they understand the differences between a form-based code and a Euclidean zoning code. That we're going to have to get away from worrying of micromanaging and worrying about use in our downtown if we're going to go with something like this. It's going to be a total mind shift for you. And it's very going to be very difficult for people to say, oh, well, I didn't know apartments could go there. That's not the right use. Well, that isn't what we're saying here. We're saying that this, if it follows this general form and it gives this feel to the area, it's okay.
Vice Mayor, if I may add just a little bit to that, to one other distinction between when we did the gateway area, we were talking about 35 square miles as opposed to an existing developed 4 square miles, where there is a need to look a little bit more fine-grained than we did in the gateway area to deal with the existing condition and how are we bringing in as we respond to light rail and how does one relate to the existing that's around it. And this is, as Councilman Richards pointed out, focused on the form and not the use. So it's still consistent, I think, with what we did in Gateway in that regard, because that talked about the general character that we were looking for in each of those larger areas also. We've talked about, with regard to what Jeff has just referred to with these character areas, we have those verbal descriptions currently. We've talked about coming back and adding in photographic images that could go with those. At this point in the process, we haven't had time to really try to identify those appropriate ones that would work. It's something we could come back and add to. But it's still done the same thing this time with words instead of pictures.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Wetzel, just as a I hate what-if questions, but why not? We talk about eliminating Euclidean zoning for form-based. I think probably the better answer there is to come up with something that's in the middle so that we have at least the ability to guide some development, at least on the front end, because pure form-based code can be a double-edged sword. Clearly, we don't want – there are certain uses we don't want downtown. And if all we're worried about is the form, then we might have the prettiest-looking dollar store you ever did see, or the prettiest-looking pawn shop you ever did see, or the prettiest little low-end – whatever you ever did see, and that isn't the vision we're going for. The reason we're trying to go to a form-based code is to get an urban feel in our downtown area, to create walkable streets, to live up to that transit-oriented development, and to maximize the benefit of our downtown area. And if you let anything happen, we might set that bar very, very low on the front end, and we'll never be able to recover. Yes. And we've seen that throughout the cities, and other cities have seen that. And recovering from that, it takes years and a lot of money that we don't have.
Right. And Vice Mayor, good point. And when we come back in a couple of weeks with a presentation on the form-based code, you'll see that it does, while it does focus on form first, it does have, with each different transact, a set of use standards to go with.
So you're looking at some kind of a hybrid model?
Correct. So it's not just total open for any use that can go in. There are limits on that.
Okay. I felt compelled to say something because otherwise this meeting might go too quickly. Anybody want to berate to John right now, or shall we let him continue?
Him right now.
All right. We'll get you one or two more slides and we'll see.
Vice Mayor, if I may add one more thing, because I've been working on it so long. We do have specific projects related to design inspiration, meaning that photo inspiration for each of the neighborhoods that we intend to do into the future, so that they'll be adopted as appendix to the plan. Okay. So we hope to follow that model, because pictures do work well when you have somebody come in.
Do you have early examples of that?
If you might be able to show me later. Yeah, if we were able to go through some of our older, some of our other PowerPoints that we've done, we come up with examples that we think reflect what we're after.
Just refresh my memory would be great. Thanks.
So back to the street character. I'm going to go through quickly through a couple of specific examples. One of the street character types of downtown Village Main Street. In this specific example, this is the intersection of Stapley and Main Street. We have applied this street character type in areas where the light rail, the transit stop will be in that most immediately adjacent and most affected by it, so in the walk shed. The intent of this street character type is to have a low-speed street that's very walkable, so you see a design speed of 25 miles per hour and a pedestrian area that's generally fairly wide that can allow a lot of activity. It's hardscape, so it can have pedestrian amenities, sidewalk cafes, things along that line. On the other end of the spectrum, the semi-urban arterial street reflects that we do still have to move some cars around, and we're going to have some diversion, but we don't want those streets just to be car only. So we still have design speeds that are reasonable, 35, 40 miles an hour, and also that the pedestrian area is still somewhat nicer, 8 to 10 feet wide, so that people still are comfortable walking on those streets, even though they are a little bit more oriented towards the car. I think now we're going to go back to John, who's going to try and show how we may handle a development proposal and review it against this plan as it comes through.
Thank you. So, Vice Mayor and Council, as we talked about, we've set a vision. We as a community and stakeholders have set the stage so private developers can come in and know what we want and try to provide that urban environment that we're after. And so just a couple of examples of how this might be used by staff or by a developer that's looking at the plan and is looking at something and what's designated in the plan as the modern downtown area, which is around the center and main light rail station. First thing that would be done would be to look at the map on page 435 of the plan, which shows the character areas and see which character area you're in. And then from there, turn to page 436, which describes then those different form types. And so a person could read through then that description of modern downtown and be able to see what we're looking for in terms of those setbacks, the intensities, the type of building form that we're after. And then also by looking on page 443, they could see the so it does take time to actually flip through the book to get to those pages. But on page 443, it describes that street character also that we're after. We wouldn't necessarily be expecting individual developments to change the street, but they would need to know what that street character is meant to be long term so that their building, again, and their design can relate to that street type that we're after. As we've mentioned, in addition to looking at the area as a whole, we created six sub-districts or neighborhoods within the overall planning area. And so each of those looks a lot more detail at the specific areas and what we would want to see. So turning to Chapter 5, then, of the plan documents, where you find those neighborhood descriptions, starting on page 5-2, there's the map that shows where those neighborhoods are. In this case, it's the downtown neighborhood, which description starts on page 5-3. And so a person can look through there and see, again, what is it we're trying to create downtown and how their project relates to that image, that vision for the downtown area. And then once they got to page 5-7, they would see the detailed map that shows, again, the fact that they're in potentially the modern downtown area. And then by turning the page over to pages 5-8 and 5-9, they see, again, in these.
Sorry.
Be able to see those specific descriptions then when we're in that specific area, what we're looking for in terms of policies and projects that we would need for to be implemented as development occurs. So again, on the bottom of page 5-8 and over on to page 5-9 are those descriptions for that specific area. So we'd use those and work with the applicant in creating that form that fits in, provides the character of the building, the types of uses that we're trying to see in that streetscape that we're after. In this downtown area where we're planning to adopt the form-based code, once that's adopted, the zoning would be in place, all those building standards would be in place, and depending upon exactly how we end up adopting it, the design characters would be in place. So it's potentially that once all those things are in place for, through council adoption of that form-based code, person would come in and they'd be going straight to plan review for that development activity. There may still be a design review function, but all the zoning issues would be taken care of. There wouldn't be any site plan requirements or any of those things. So again, the form-based code will take us a long way down the road in facilitating that private development to occur. In contrast, another example we have is along the urban transit corridor, which is Main Street, basically east of the downtown area. And in particular, we have designated areas that are considered primarily for residential. We go out to the easternmost neighborhood we've identified, the Gilbert Main neighborhood, in your plan document. And that's found starting on page 5-44. Find out about the Gilbert Main area. So we would have started first in that chapter 4, looked at what the character is of a given area, and then gone out here to the neighborhood pages. And again, a person being able to look through on those pages and see more specifically, you have the urban retail village, or the urban transit village, excuse me, character in several different places. And while it generally means the same thing, there are specific characteristics in a given area that might be applied. So by looking at page 549, you see specifically when we talk about the urban transit village in this location along Main Street, what we intend, what some of the policies are, what some of the objectives are, what projects might need to be completed. So again, that's how a person can flip through the plan and use the document to understand what we're looking for and how they might develop on a given location. So that again is an overview of the different chapters in the plan and what it does, how we can use it as a city, how citizens and applicants can use it in the future to guide development, to create the type of vision that we're setting for the area. As far as the continued process, Planning and Zoning Board will be holding a public hearing on the plan at their December meeting. And then based on that, if they're ready, they could make a recommendation. They may end up taking a couple meetings to look at it, but once they're done and have made their recommendation, be back to council for your final review and action.
Final comments?
Question? You guys, you did this all in-house?
Yes.
Yeah, this is really impressive. This is a great detail. I'm looking and going, cool, I like this. I mean, just very specific on each area. Very impressive.
Thank you.
Very good, thanks.
Very good. Gentlemen,
how about we move on to item 2B here, presentation, discuss, provide direction, update on impact fee rate process. I was expecting Mr. Butler. He's behind you making faces.
Sure, there's many people behind me.
How the legislature heard me. Yes.
Oops.
So.
Okay. Vice Mayor and Council, this morning what we'd like to do is update you on some actions that will need to be taken over this next month. And as you notice, there is an agenda item on the 21st, your meeting for the 21st. And it's one of the actions that we'll need to take. So we want to give you an overview of what's coming to you this month, and then what's coming to you in the next spring and over the next couple years due to some legislation.
As you go through this, do you have an estimate on, or maybe it's just a guesstimate at this point, on what this might cost taxpayers?
I do have an estimate on what the actions you'll be taking over this next month will be to the city of Mesa.
Uh-huh.
That is, I can tell you, for the 11-12 budget year, it's $182,000. In impact fees we will not be able to collect. And annualized, that would be $364,000 for the 12-13 year.
Okay.
That's for the action you'll be taking this month. And we'll go through that, and I'll explain exactly where that comes from.
Yeah, I'll let you go through this presentation, and I'll throw in questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
What do you want to point out, though, this is not an overall presentation on everything that has changed in the impact fee legislation. We'll be coming back to you in the spring to go over all the changes and what that's going to mean to the city of Mesa. What we're going to talk about today is the process that we need to go through over this next month and then the upcoming cycle. Our last impact fee study was completed in May 21st of 2007, so that was quite some time ago. Since then, we have not been able to do an update to our impact fees, as the state has put us on hold, basically, for the last few years, and we haven't been able to change any of the fees. That changed last spring. when Senate Bill 1525 was approved back in April of 2011. That made some significant changes to impact fee legislation. Some of those changes include projects that were previously allowable for impact fee rates are now excluded from your impact fee rate studies. Some of these include libraries over 10,000 square feet in size, fire or police training facilities are no longer allowable, and parks over 30 acres in size. The other two areas are our cultural and general government facility projects. Any projects that fall into these two categories are no longer allowable for future impact fee rates. And we'll get to what that is, difference between our previous rates and our future rates.
What's the size of the Red Mountain Library?
Probably closer to
20. Yeah. 20. What was its original size when we built it? Because there was an add-on, I believe.
12.
12. So we could do one of those, but you have to...
Under 10,000 square feet could be within the impact fees.
Okay.
We could still build a facility, of course. We just wouldn't be able to include it in our impact fee study, in our impact fee rate.
But if we were to add, because this is going to impact Southeast Mesa more than any other, like we could build...
Our Mesa Express Library, obviously...
We could do those. Could build a permanent facility of 10,000 square feet in the area.
Yes.
Does anything in the law preclude us 2 years later from adding on if we had to under general obligation?
Well, you can always do general obligations, just you can't use impact fees.
You can't use the impact fees toward that, no.
But we can use impact fees to pay off the original 10,000 is what I'm asking.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we were to do what we did with Red Mountain, build a 10,000 square foot facility, add on another 10,000 a few years later to regionalize the library, we could still use the impact fees to pay off the original 10,000.
For the first 10,000 square feet.
Okay.
Yeah, and just to clarify that, the position of the various cities that we've been working on is if you built a 20,000 square foot library facility, you could use impact fees for the first 10,000 at original construction.
We don't
have to do it in phases.
Right.
Back door. Okay. Right. Yes, ma'am.
Is there, and this probably is more of a Butler question, was there a reason why they wanted to eliminate the fire and police training facilities, that type of thing?
I'd love to know. Vice Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, I thought you were about to say libraries, and I didn't want to call out any other cities. So thank you for shifting that to fire and police. The position of the home builders has always been that training facilities are typically regional facilities that cities have constructed, especially in areas outside of the East Valley, and have co-shared those facilities. Like in the West Valley, there are several cities who have come together to pay for and operate a West Valley public training facility, and they didn't feel, because of the nature of the region or the regional nature of those facilities, that it was fair to burden individual homeowners to pay for the regional facility. So obviously cities and towns have a different opinion of that, but as part of the negotiation on 1525, there's a lot to hate, but there's a lot that had initially been excluded from the bill that we were able to keep in to the bill as well. And so, like every good compromise, there's a lot that they don't like that's still in there, but there's a lot that we don't like that was included as well.
Sure.
And that's one of those.
What brings us here over this next month is that any impact fees that we are currently collecting on the projects that are now considered excluded from impact fees can no longer be collected after January 1st of 2012. Now, the stipulation to that is if we are paying debt, some type of a financing on the projects, and we are collecting impact fees in order to repay that debt, we are allowed to continue to collect those impact fees after the January 1st date. By August 1st, 2014, all municipalities must adopt a new infrastructure improvement plan and an impact fee study in order to continue assessing impact fees at that point. So we are allowed to continue doing the impact, collecting the impact fees we are today through August 1st of 2014. At that point, we have to have a new impact fee study and plan based on a new infrastructure improvement plan. So the staff is beginning to work on that and planning out that process. But those are the main changes that we need to discuss today.
Dave?
Two parts of the question. Do we have any fund balance for fees collected? Have we?
Yes, we do.
We have, okay.
Oh, for some of the.
We've collected so far?
Yeah, so if we,
yes,
have,
we, do
if we have fund balance.
We have fund balance, and we can continue to use that fund balance.
Okay, so that we don't have to have that expended by a certain time or. I don't think we have anything financed.
We do have things financed, and that's what we're going to get into, is we do have our parks facilities that we've discussed, our public safety training facility, are all financed. Those are bonds.
Right.
And so bonds is a financing mechanism. So the debt service that we have on those bonds, we can continue to collect our impact fees for our fire and police and parks and library because we are paying the debt on the projects that were allowable at the time that we completed the project.
And so what about like a cultural impact fee? And that's being eliminated. Do we have a fund balance in that? And is it affected in any way by this?
Very small.
We do have a fund balance, but there is no debt service that exists with cultural facilities. So we'll have to discontinue collecting those fees.
Okay, so we can discontinue them, but we can still spend the balance.
That is correct. I think until 2020, we have to spend those, or we would have to refund those. I don't think that will be a problem.
And our cultural impact fee balance as of June 30th was just over $500,000, so $529,000. Our general governmental was $4.6 million, but we are using that for our City Edge project, and that will be expended by the deadline.
So it's committed.
It's committed. It is currently committed.
Be careful when you say balance. If it's committed, it's not a balance.
It's not a. It's a committed balance. The balance is there, but it's committed to a project. It's currently underway.
The cultural as well, and the City Edge.
The general governmental is committed to the City Edge project.
And the cultural is committed to which project?
Well, I don't think that that's fully committed at this time. There are some projects that are in the pipeline to spend that money, but they'll have to come forward through this cycle.
We want to come. That's something. I committed to council the first of the year we were going to come back and talk about all the capital projects. Mm-hmm. The challenge is on cultural is that it has to still meet the definition. Uh-huh. Or it can't just be a repair or replacement of an existing facility.
Well, it's like the expansion.
It has to be
an
related to expansion or new venue. So that's, and there's plenty of opportunities for that, but we need to talk about that. So it's just not a simple go in. To something that's existing today, would have to be something new or expansive, and of course sometimes that also brings with it operating costs. So that's why we want to have that discussion in the future. So,
Councilmember Kevin, that was it. Okay. While you're sitting there,
yes, sir.
Since this is a revenue stream that we use to pay off our bonds, do we anticipate any issues with our bond rating because of?
There should not be, due to the size of the issues that we're dealing with, and we're able to continue for everything that we've got, it should not impact our rating.
And we did talk about the cultural and the general governmental facilities are no longer eligible for impact fees. We don't have any, the city does not have any outstanding debt on these particular projects, so those fees will need to discontinue as of January 1st, 2012. That is, the item that's on the agenda for the 21st is the introduction of that ordinance to discontinue those two fees within our fee rate schedule. Okay. The second action that we'll be asking you to take or to consider in the next month is memorializing our prior debt pledges. What this is doing is actually saying for those facilities like the public safety training facility, for our parks programs and so forth, that we do actually have outstanding debt. That at the time that we went into that debt and financed those projects, we were anticipating the repayment of that debt with our impact fee collections. And therefore, we will be continuing our impact fee rates past January 1st until that debt is repaid. This will be coming to you as a resolution, and you'll be taking action and considering that resolution the same time you're taking action and considering the ordinance. So it's come through on December 5th. The city is working with all of the other cities and the League of Cities to work on a model ordinance. This will be coming to you in the spring of 2012. This ordinance is something that all of the cities are working together to have one ordinance to come into the regulations of SB 1525. So in the spring, we'll be coming forward to you with MESA's version. Just means we'll be putting in some items specific to Mesa. We'll be following the model ordinance that all the other cities are following. And at that time, we'll be able to go over the specifics of exactly what changed in the legislation and what we need to be aware of for Mesa's interests. On that, this is an overall schedule of what's going to be happening in order for us to fully comply with SB 1525. On November 21st is the introduction of the ordinance that will discontinue general governmental and cultural impact fees, effective January 1st. December 5th, we'll be coming through with the actual action on the ordinance and action on the resolution that repledges or stipulates that we have pledged these impact fees towards debt when it comes to fire, police, public safety, library, and so forth. On January 1st, we will then discontinue collecting cultural and general governmental fees for impact fees. Okay. In the spring, we'll come back to you with a model ordinance for discussion and direction and consideration. Over this time, the city staff and engineering and in all of the various departments will start working on our new infrastructure improvement plan, which is required as part of the new legislation. That is a long-term process. So we'll be doing that all the way through till we get to August 2014 when the new fees need to be in place. So then I would anticipate coming back to you in the spring of 2014 with our actual plan and what those recommended rates are going to be out of that impact fee plan.
Councilwoman Higgins.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. I guess this is actually another Scott Butler question. But do you anticipate any of this changing with like a new I see a lot of frowning, shaking heads. Yeah. But.
Vice Mayor and Councilwoman Higgins, no, we don't believe in the next few years. Part of the agreement with the Home Builders Association was a moratorium on any further legislation unless it was mutually agreed upon, meaning, you know, if we found some technical errors in the drafting of the bill, which, you know, is very common after the fact, and we both agreed it was something that was an inadvertent drafting error and we needed to go back and fix, then that could proceed over the next three-year period. But that was part of our agreement, was a moratorium, and also the governor attached a signing letter, which is rare. When she signs a bill, she usually doesn't send out a message with that, but she did in this case, stating that she thought that this was very fair reform and that she intends this to be the last bill that she signs while she's in office. So we're very hopeful that with the agreement that's in place and also from the words of the governor that she doesn't intend to see any follow-up legislation, that we'll have a few years to make sure that this bill gets enacted and we see how it's working before any types of further legislations introduced by the home builders.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
And on that, that's the end. If there's any questions.
Are there any questions? Other questions, comments, or in this particular instance, profanities? No? All right, thank you very much. Item number three is appointments to board and committees. The mayor has made two recommendations, and it has been a motion on the floor by Councilmember Kavanaugh, seconded by Mr. Glover. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Passes unanimously. Acknowledgments of receipts and minutes. I have a motion by Councilwoman Higgins, a second by Councilmember Richens. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Here are meetings and conferences attended. Mr. Kavanaugh, I think you have quite a bit to say on this.
I want to report on two events that have been important to the city. Last week, Arizona hosted the National League of Cities annual meeting, and I wanted to thank all the members of the council and city staff who were very active in participating in the workshops and seminars. We had over 3,000 members from the National League of Cities in Arizona. Mesa was a very active participant in that. Our Channel 11 staff, our PIO staff, did a great job on iMesa. Councilmember Richens was very active in presentations, as well as others. And from all accounts that I've heard, the conference was a great success, and Mesa staff and the city were integral to the planning for the event and hosting for it, as well as executing it last week. And so I wanted to thank everybody who was involved in that. And my thanks comes on behalf of the NLC board. The other event I wanted to comment on is Councilmember Higgins and I were able to attend the graduation ceremony for the 49th Citizens Police Academy at our training facility last night. And again, it was a great and varied class of residents in our community who came together on a 12-week program to learn how our police department operates and why it's one of the best in the country. And so I want to congratulate, again, all those residents who participated in that program. It was a wonderful event last night. Thank you.
Yes?
I had the opportunity to attend the memorial service at the Mesa Cemetery for 23 Royal Air Force pilots that are buried there when they did their training at Falcon Field during World War II. And this ceremony has been going on, I think, for like 60 years. People still fly in from England, the actual cadets that were here during World War II, and they're just darling little 92-year-old guys that are only this big, but used to fly, you know, combat jets. So jets, not jets, planes. It's always an honor to be there. It's a very cool ceremony, and it's just reminds us of that rich part of our history that some people don't even know. But we're really linked together with a big group of British citizens, and we take care of their guys they left behind. So it's a special time, and it's every Sunday on Memorial Day weekend with the flyover over the cemetery. It's very nice.
Thank you, and I will mention, and maybe Dave will add some detail to this, but I want to thank his neighbor who kindly let us use his vehicle as part of the Veterans Day Parade, the Mayor Day. Chris, I believe, and I were sitting in that, and so was Dave up in the front seat. Looked like the Kennedy convertible that went by. Fortunately, on the route, we weren't passing the any book depositories, and just in case, we put the mayor over in that seat. So, but it was I am a little bad, aren't I? I'm a little bad. No, it was fantastic. I tell you, the mayor could not stop commenting on how well attended that event was, and each and every year since a private organization, a nonprofit, took that over, that event has grown each and every year, and it is an absolute asset to downtown Mesa. I was thoroughly impressed with the number of folks who showed up and the quality of the entrance in the parade. It was absolutely fantastic. It was a lot of fun to participate in. Also, special thanks to the police department who helped barricade that area off so we didn't get all run over. And the Mesa firefighters were very kind and donated their time and supplies and materials to cook hot dogs for all the participants. So much thanks to them. Mr. Richens, who's your neighbor so we could thank him?
Oh, Chris Nunez. Yeah. He has a 69 Cadillac limousine that he chopped the top off of. It's pretty cool.
It was fun.
I was just going to comment that I had attended the what they call the 12% luncheon, which is the 12% gaming revenues that the Salt River, Pima, Maricopa Indian Nation gives to charities throughout the valley. There were a lot of different charities represented at the event. Our United Food Bank was there as a recipient of some of that money, and also our immunization programs that our firefighters run to immunize people against childhood diseases in Mesa, and there were several other organizations there. It was truly impressive the amount of money that the tribe is able to give out because of those gaming revenues. And the vice president of the tribe, in his closing remarks, likened it to when settlers first came to the valley, how much they were able to help out people when they came with food and supplies and getting them situated when people came into their lands originally hundreds of years ago, and how they feel that sense of helping them again because they have these revenues available to them. So it was a really neat event, and it was well participated across the valley. Thanks.
Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. Just a reminder that it is a Public Safety Committee meeting on Monday. I believe it starts at 3:30, and then we'll have a study session beginning at 5:15 and followed by our City Council meeting at 5:45. Thank you.
Can I point out?
Okay.
Tonight at 5 o'clock, if anyone wants to join us out at Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport, it's the inaugural flight of the nonstop Allegiant airline from Mesa to Las Vegas. Whee! That's at 5 o'clock. And there's another event tonight at, I believe, from 4 to 7 at the Commemorative Air Force Museum at Falcon Field, and it's called Aviation Fascination. And it's a free event with food and planes and cool stuff. And last year I would say there were 1,000 people there or so. It was well attended last year. So if you have the opportunity and parking, you can actually park across the street in the Walmart parking, because it is there's not enough room to park. But it was very fun last year, and so take the kids. It's something fun to do. Take the kids, take your whoever. A lot of people. So tonight it's called Aviation Fascination.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thanks for adding those. Those are going to be really important deals. Items from citizens present?
No speakers.
We have no speakers. We have a motion to go into executive session and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We are in executive session.